From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in late 2000 when British journalist and author Andrew Sullivan launched his own blog, calling it The Daily Dish. Over the course of more than 14 years, Sullivan became one of the most powerful and well-read bloggers. He attracted a diverse audience, perhaps thanks to his own rather unusual profile, a gay conservative living with HIV who supported President George W. Bush before becoming a strong backer of President Obama. Sullivan and his staff wrote around 300 blog posts per week. And this past Friday, he wrote his last. He retired from blogging with this explanation, quote, "I am saturated in digital life and I want to return to the actual world again. I am a human being before I'm a writer and a writer before I'm a blogger. And although it's been a joy and a privilege to have helped pioneer a genuinely new form of writing, I yearn for other older forms. I want to read again, slowly, carefully. I want to absorb a difficult book and walk around in my own thoughts with it for a while. I want to have an idea and let it slowly take shape rather than be instantly blogged," end quote. But does the retirement of one of the most well-read bloggers signal the end of the blog era? Well, some say it does. MSNBC's Benji Sarlin writes that the blog era died last Friday when Sullivan's final post was published. Dramatic, maybe, but he's not the only one who says so. BuzzFeed's Ben Smith has been writing for several years that blogs are changing or dying and their function is being absorbed by, among other things, Twitter. This hour, I want to know what you still read, what blogs you still read regularly. Have your habits changed? My guests for the hour have not changed very much for the benefit of all of us. Doug Jay is here. Doug Jay has been blogging for a long time, first at Rochester Turning back in 2006, was it, Doug?
Yes, that's when I began.
2006, then briefly blogged for the Albany Project in 2008. Been blogging for Balloon Juice from 2009 to the present. By the way, Balloon Juice is a very well-read, progressive-leaning blog, roughly 50,000 readers a day or so.
Yep, that's about right.
That's about right. So that's where Doug Jay is now. Leonard is here. Leonard writes for Balloon Juice as well. He's been chronicling his local congressional district for years as kind of a specialty blogger who chronicled the exciting days of Randy Cool and then the rise and the fall of Eric Massa, among other things. Feels so long ago, doesn't it, Leonard?
Yes, but almost like it was yesterday.
Almost like it was yesterday. When we were talking about snorkeling and all the weird things associated with Eric Massa. Tom Belknap's here. He's been writing a blog called Dragonfly Eye, focusing on science, technology, and all things Rochester. Tom, nice to see you.
Very nice to be here. Thank you.
And Leah Stacey's here. She's a publisher of 585 Magazine. She teaches at Nazareth College about blogs and new media, and your students are writing blogs, aren't they?
They are.
You wouldn't have them write blogs if we were in the post-blog era.
Well, I hope you ask me more about that.
Well, we have a lot to talk about. And I'm going to start with the question of Andrew Sullivan and whether this... I mean, did you all write a poem? Did you all compose? Doug, I know this for you has been a hard couple days.
It's been a hard few... You know, I don't think I commented much on it. No, I think I might have written a couple tweets about it, but that's about it.
Were they snarky tweets? Most of your
tweets
were smart.
Yeah, of course.
That's your stock and trade.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess my feeling is that I think the whole whether or not blogs are dead is unfortunately, I think, a fair question. There has been a lot of absorption of stuff into Twitter instead. But I don't think that the retirement of Andrew Sullivan is particularly noteworthy.
Okay. I'll be the one on the panel to say I was a regular Dish reader. In fact, I was a paying subscriber. Later in the hour, we're going to talk about the new business models and whether they work or not. I think Sullivan was probably an outlier there as opposed to the new trend. But Leonard, you shed any tears for Andrew Sullivan?
No. I don't. He was too hysterical for my taste.
Too hysterical for your taste.
Right, yeah. So every day the world was ending or the new great thing. He didn't have an even keel. Plus, I think he was overrated. He was essentially a Washington insider. I mean, insofar as he's a self-proclaimed pioneer, there are many others that were also pioneering at the time that are still around. So,
wouldn't he agree, though, that he was hysterical? Wasn't that part of his charm, was that he was self-aware about that?
Well, his charm escaped me, so I don't know, but I'll take your word for it.
Tom Belknap, we are not in the post-blog era, or it's a fair question?
I mean, it's a fair question whether the technology and the information move in the same way, but that's a whole separate question. I think in terms of whether blogging is relevant depends greatly on who's doing the blogging. On a technological level, 76 million websites and 22% of all domain names registered in the United States are running on WordPress alone. That's just one platform for blogging, not counting Blogger or Ghost or a number of others. So if one guy with the good fortune to be rich enough to decide he's going to retire to read a book decides to go away, I don't think the rest of the community is going to be too overly shaken up by it.
I'm going to make an appeal to our listeners. There must be some dish heads in the audience. And if you're a dish head, call the program and join me in defending Andrew Sullivan from these vultures here. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. So, Leah, if you're teaching class next week and someone says, look, I see a lot of conversations about the way, for example, the way Twitter has kind of changed things. I hear the term microblogging, or the fact that Twitter is where people are getting information more quickly, and maybe it used to be blogs. How has that impacted the landscape?
Well, in the class that I teach, we talk about Twitter and we talk about blogging. We actually use Tumblr for our blogs, which is a blogging platform that's more visual than some of the others, and that seems to work really well for what we do, because technically what I'm teaching them is writing for digital media. I'm not teaching them how to blog. They've grown up with blogging. They've grown up in the digital world. They are more digitally native than we are. And so I am teaching them how to write in a digital sphere, and I've chosen blogging because it's the most collaborative way we can do that in the class. With Twitter, microblog is a term that came up in our textbook, I believe, 2 weeks ago, and the kids were like, we've never heard this term.
Yeah.
And I was like, no one uses this term. We don't care. Just call it Twitter.
But I understand the function and the point of it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a tiny... And I tell them, you know, a tweet is like a tiny blog post. You have so many characters. You have so much time to get your opinion into the digital sphere. And so we use it for that. We also use it to chronicle events. You know, we do live tweeting in the class. It's one of their big assignments. And that is really just a live blog in smaller chunks, which, as attention spans are growing smaller and smaller with all of this digital noise, it almost seems like live tweeting is working better for some events than a live blog, per se.
Let me get our first caller in, because my appeal has found a dish head. I think Joe in Rochester will join me as the only dish heads on the panel today. Joe?
Yes.
Are you a dish head?
I am formally a dish head. Have been for a couple of years.
You're not going to let Andrew Sullivan take this abuse from our panel today, are you?
No, I absolutely will. I think that's...
You're a self-hating dish head then, Joe.
Well, I think a lot of us were. You know, it's one of the appeals of Sullivan to me was his kind of raw honesty and willingness to be challenged. And I think that for me, you know, I started reading him maybe 2007 or so after reading The Conservative Soul, which really profoundly altered me. And I always kind of really loved his brutal honesty and his willingness to be challenged and the way in which he wasn't insular. I really respect that, and I'm sad to see that go. I think there's a kind of balkanization going on around opinion anyway. So I will support him for that. There's certainly plenty to disagree with him on. But, you know, that's what I appreciate.
Well, Joe,
it.
Hang in there for a second. Joe makes an important point here. I don't know of any other blogger or sort of big personality in media who was as consistently willing to publish dissents from readers. I mean, isn't there some virtue there?
There is, but don't forget he didn't have comments. I mean,
he didn't have a comment section.
He didn't have a comment section. And so he could curate the dissents. I mean, you know, believe me, when you write for a blog with comments, you get a lot of dissent that you don't get, you know, you don't get to only, you know, readers get to see the ones that are a little bit less polite.
I mean,
to put it mildly.
There's plenty of stuff that happens in the comment section that you really wish had not happened in the comment section or anywhere.
Yeah, yeah.
But then again, Josh Marshall is another pioneer of the same vein, and he did the same thing. There was never any comments, at least on his main
blog. That's Talking Points Memo.
Talking Points Memo.
Right. Yeah.
But he also did publish dissent and also did a good job of curating not just dissent, but also tips from people that were in the know very well. So it that goes around in that vein early on in the history.
I think those are good points. And Joe, you know, Did that ever bother you as a reader? Did you ever want to comment on regular? I kind of found it refreshing that there were no comment section on Sullivan, because I didn't get bogged down in, you know, there are YouTube comments, which is like the worst level of humanity. There are Twitter mentions for famous people, which are the second worst level. And then sometimes there are blog comment sections, though I will say there are also some very intelligent people in comment sections. Did it ever bother you that there weren't with Sullivan?
I don't think so, and I think probably because, like you guys are mentioning, the comment sections are often such a hot mess anyway, and you know the really valuable conversations that I was having, you know, would often transfer over to other mediums, and so you know we would post a Sullivan piece and then debate it on Facebook, for example. And he was also pretty gracious about publishing a lot of that stuff and really difficult things. I mean, he has a whole thread on late-term abortion that's really worth reading. It's difficult to read. And that's, I think, worthwhile. I don't know. I think it speaks to the need for editorial in the kind of media landscape a little bit.
Joe, as a subscriber to Andrew Sullivan, what are you going to read? Are you going to read anything in its place, or give me a sense for what you read on a daily basis?
Oh, I don't know. I'm still in my grieving phase.
Don't roll your eyes, Leonard. Give him his space to grieve.
Yeah. I read a broad array of things. So everything from, you know, Washington Post to the American Conservative, just trying to challenge myself. There's, you know, I'm an academic, so I read a lot of those blogs as well, and, you know, find out a lot about information that way. I think, you know, to go in line with something you guys were talking about yesterday, of my generation, I'm in my 30s. I don't really follow official media very often. I think we're getting our sources in much more interesting places, Glenn Greenwald, things like that. So for whatever that's worth, I think it's, you know, the challenge for me going forward, I think it's going to be to find diverse people that challenge me. That's what I'm looking for anyway.
Yeah, maybe it's better safe for a separate day, but Doug's had some interesting interaction with Glenn Greenwald. Maybe we'll save it
for
a
different
day.
Maybe we'll save that.
but Joe, last question for you, and I'll let you go.
Sure.
You paid to subscribe to Sullivan, and we're going to talk about this hour. I don't think that's a model that works for most. He had a huge readership. And, you know, he had something like 30,000 plus subscribers and $1 million in annual revenue, which is great. I don't think it's duplicatable for most. Are you paying to subscribe to others, and would you?
I don't know. That's a good question. You know, I have been reading Sullivan for so long that I think there was a kind of affinity there, and I don't know that that's transferable. I don't pay to read other people. There are certainly some who I would. I think Ta-Nehisi Coates does amazing work, and I would definitely support him. And I don't, you know, I'll leave the business models up to you guys to figure out. But
Thank you, Joe. Thanks for the call. Thanks for chiming in as a fellow dish head here. I needed support in numbers there. But when Sullivan went 2 years ago to a pay model, I figured it would work because he had a huge readership, and there were people like Joe, people like me, who had been reading for a while and wanted to continue. But with 30,000 or something subscribers, I mean, that's still a small percentage of what his readership used to be. Balloon Juice ever? I mean, is that model just not really feasible for most, Doug?
I don't think it's feasible for us, no. And on top of that, we're hobbyists anyway. I mean, I don't think that Leonard or I is that interested in making money off it anyway.
Leonard? So.
No, I'm not interested in making money off of it. Balloon Juice is supported by ads, which internet advertising is probably the biggest scam ever perpetrated on consumers in the last decade. But so we have all these trashy Google ads that essentially pay for the hosting. And then whenever something comes up, the guy who runs the blog, who lives in a 300-person town in West Virginia, will put out a request for funds and he'll get as much money as he wants in a few hours, but from the dedicated readers. So he'll make a couple grand in a couple hours, and then he, you know, shuts it off.
But why does he have to do that? I mean, you say a couple
it's
grand.
It's for something special. So when he wants to send somebody to Netroots Nation or he wants to a conference, he'll do that. If he wants to do a redesign of the blog, he'll put out a big for that.
So, interesting. Okay, so he's not looking to fund full-time positions, or even his own. He's looking to pay for, hey, I'd like to get one of our staff folks to go. I'd like to pay for it.
Right.
And will our readers do that? They'll cover a few thousand dollars, but we're not talking full-time positions.
Yeah, right. That's right.
Okay.
On the issue of making money, I'll give you my PayPal email account at the end of this so anybody can send whatever money they like. 100% willing to make money if it's there. But the problem for some of us is that one of the things that in doing the reading coming in for the interview, one of the things that is a major trend in blogging such as it is highly specialized blogging.
Yeah.
That's a decision that I made in response to a lot of the same concerns that bring us here today. I decided reading through my blog that honestly doing the politics stuff, even if I'm not rehashing what someone else said, someone else is going to say it anyway. So what am I doing? If I wanted to be able to contribute positively to the local community, I needed to find a niche that was going to work. So why not take my experience with science and technology and ability to break that down and sort of take subjects that are happening here and say, this is how it works on a scientific level. This is where are the claims being made true or false based on what we can compile from science. So that's good. I think I've done some good, but it's not the kind of thing you're going to get a lot of pay for. And you're going to get a lower readership for the result. But which would you rather do? Would you rather try to make money in a small market in the first place, or would you rather try to make a difference in a place that you love?
And I think what you're describing is what a blog really is. If you look at – I looked up eBiz lists the top 15 blogs. Huffington Post to me is not a blog. You know, the Daily Beast is not a blog to me. I mean, Leah Stacey, what is a blog?
Hmm. Well, I do teach that those are – they were blogs.
They were.
And I think we are, you know, you've mentioned the post-blog era. I think we're in it. And I think, I'm going to be really bold here, I think the post-blog era is niche blogs. And that's really what I teach the kids. I teach them to pick an interest that appeals to an audience and to pursue that interest and become really, really knowledgeable about that interest, whether it's food, whether it's a certain company that they may want to work for, because let's face it, companies have blogs now and somebody has to write those blogs, right? And we don't appreciate bad writing. So I'm giving them the skills to do that. And it's, you know, anytime you're writing for an audience, like they're saying, they get money in a couple of hours at Balloon Juice if they put out a call. It's because they are giving the readers something that the readers want. And that's what you're doing with your readers, Tom. You're giving them something that they learn from, that they feel they're benefiting from. And that's just how business has always worked. So I think if you're going to have subscribers, you have to be leaving them feeling like they're way better off than before they read your blog.
I still, though, I maybe I'm wrong. I've thought for years, if you could go back to the mid to late 90s, the Washington Post and the New York Times went a different way than the Wall Street Journal. The Wall Street Journal essentially, I think they were paywall from the beginning. And the New York Times and the Washington Post put free content out there. And then, of course, we've watched the New York Times sort of try to transmogrify into these hybrids where, you know, the paying for the editorial page. What did they call? I'm trying to remember what they called that. That was kind of a silly. Yeah.
Times Plus.
There was something.
Yeah, Times Premium.
Something like that. Yeah. And that sort of flopped. But maybe our panel disagrees. If they could go back to the mid to late 90s, maybe people would always want free content, and maybe competition indicates that there would have to be widespread collusion to create this expectation of paying. But we're 20 years into this internet business, and people think that things should be free. Leonard, was that ever going to be different?
Well, if you want to play woulda, shoulda, coulda, I think if they would have stayed paywall, they would have found out what I think everybody knows is that the baseline of news is commodified. What people essentially need to know on the day-to-day basis is a commodity they can get pretty much anywhere, right? They can go to news.google.com and get that if they want. So the idea that somebody who wasn't inclined to pay for a subscription to the Post or the Times would be inclined to pay for it because they were somehow, the Times or the Post could somehow cut that down, I don't think that would work. So
it also kind of goes back to the digital era in general, and MP3s were the big thing that we talked about first, about, well, people are getting free content. But in an economic sense, the value of something is a question of its availability and your desire to have it. Now, I don't think I would have bought any No Doubt CDs without MP3s. But I listen to it on the radio. I can
download
it.
And it really changed your life.
And it's well, yeah. I mean, you've read my sonnets. Yeah.
You're just a girl in the world.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. But, you know, it's a false sense of value to say that, you know, that because somebody can get it for free, they got something for free that they would have paid for, right? So, you know, again, I've never owned a copy of the New York Times in my life, and I still don't. I don't have a subscription, but I read it from time to time online. Would I have paid for it in the 90s? No. And now, no. So value is a much more amorphous concept than we tend to think it is. And we all, in the news business, where they're trying desperately to pull themselves up by the bootstraps, they want to look at that as all a commodity that they can get charged money for. And it really doesn't work that way.
And maybe that goes back to part of what Leah and everyone is saying, which is that the Wall Street Journal, it was easier for them to go behind a paywall because they're technically more specialized, because that is technically more specialized
exactly.
content that people are looking for, as opposed to the Times or the Post. So maybe I am naive.
The Hill has always been pay ever since they've been online too. Right. But who's going to pay for The Hill except for somebody that's on The Hill? Probably not a lot.
Mike Allen and like a dozen other people probably. Right. But
I do think one thing about the news that makes it different from a lot of other things is that it's always been, aside from a few publications, essentially free. I mean, newspapers, you paid $1 for a newspaper. That was about how much it cost to print it. Aside from public radio, I don't know of any news sources that ever made money by readers paying them. All the profit was always advertisements. And so I think that people were getting something physical for the 50 cents for a newspaper, and that was about 50 cents of paper that it cost. So there just isn't a history of news being funded aside from public radio by anything other than advertisements.
I'm going to get back to the phones in just a second. I think that point's well taken. And look, it's easy for me in public radio to say, didn't we have the right model? You know, you ask people to vote with their wallet. We're very proud to do that. But Leah Stacey is not only teaching on modern media, but she's the publisher of 585 magazine. And you're out there competing as well for dollars that are hard to come by. I mean, it's hard for everybody to convince people to pay for content.
Yeah. And, you know, magazines are kind of going the same way. They're becoming niche. You know, we appeal to the 585 region. Outside of that, our subscribers in Florida, they used to live here. Our subscribers in Virginia have family who live here. Everybody has a connection to us, and that's why they care, you know, because they might see their next door neighbor from childhood or something when they open our pages. Without that, we don't have a national appeal. So by becoming more specialized, that's how magazines in some ways are coming back into trend. And you see that the magazines that are going under are the ones that have just sort of this blanket audience. They don't have a really specific audience, but those specified publications they're still going.
Let me get back to the phones. This is Scott and Henrietta. Go ahead, Scott.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to start by thanking the gentleman on the panel. I'm a regular reader of Balloon Juice, so thank you for the work. Following on from that, a previous caller made a comment about balkanization and perhaps polarization. And I wanted to get your panel's thoughts on that. I'm presently reading a biography of John Adams, and speaks quite a bit about the election of 1800 and the absolute vitriol that came out of the Federalist rags and the Republican rags of the time, and they were extremely one-sided. And we look at the way that people talk about blogs polarizing things now, and I'm wondering if there is anything quantitative around that, or are we just going ahead and idealizing the 1950s and 60s again and saying, well, geez, those, you know, Walter Cronkite, he was a really straight-laced guy, but now things are really bad. So I wonder if your panel could comment on those thoughts.
So I think you make a really good point. I think all the stuff about balkanization is way, way overestimated. I read lots of, so I'm very liberal. I read lots of conservative stuff that I never read before. I read lots of stuff from the way far left that I never read before, which usually angers me much more than the conservative stuff, by the way. and so I think the balkanization thing is really, I think it's greatly exaggerated. And I think that the thing about the past with Walter Cronkite and so on is that was a really centrist establishment point of view. I think for a long time people had no choice but to swallow, you know, the centrist establishment point of view. And that's not a good thing. I mean, it was everybody hearing the same type of stuff, and I don't see how that's beneficial as opposed to people being able to read diversity of opinion.
It's also worth noting that when you're talking about the sort of yellow journalism and that era, you're talking about newspapers where there might not be another newspaper in your city. Mm-hmm. Literally, there's nothing. Now you have any number of options, unlimited number of options to read. If you choose to read only one set of things, it's probably because you weren't going to buy into what anybody else was going to tell you anyway.
Right. And the barrier to entry to extremism is a lot lower today than it was back in the 60s, but there was a lot of it. I mean, there was a John Birch Society. Their records were sent around for people to listen to whatever, you know, nutty right-wing views they wanted to listen to. Now that's out in the open. That's anybody can get on the internet. So it's just more. What was there already is just more evident too. I think is going one of the factors.
Let me remind our listeners of our panel here as we talk about the post-blog era. Andrew Sullivan's retirement on Friday officially marked it. We've been saying that with tongue in cheek this hour, but we are talking about the function of blogs and their future, with a number of people with a long experience in blogging, and studying. Essentially studying the media landscape. Doug Jay and Leonard, who write for Balloon Juice. It's balloon-juice.com. 50,000 readers a day, one of the really more popular progressive-leaning blogs. And Leonard, do you want to mention your handle on there? If people want to read posts by Leonard.
Mr. Mix.
You are Mr. Mix. And Doug Jay is Doug Jay. Tom Belknap's here. His blog is called Dragonfly Eye. It's dragonflyeye.net, focusing on science, technology, and all things Rochester. Leah Stacey is the publisher of 585 Magazine and teaches at Nazareth College about blogs and new media. I'm going to come back in 60 seconds. We've got some more questions coming in online and comments as well. If you want to join the program, it's 844-295-TALK. 844-295-8255. And Paul Krugman weighed in on this, talked about what he calls war blogging. He says, before we start eulogizing Andrew Sullivan, we should remember where he was when he started. And I want to ask if there is a big difference, if war blogging still exists, and is there a political divide? Are right-wing blogs sort of inherently different than left-wing? We're going to talk about that and more after 60 seconds on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. Andrew Sullivan's retirement on Friday did bring a lot of comments around the blogosphere. Does the blogosphere, is that still a thing, by the way?
If you're still living in 2006.
Yes. If you're still living in 2006.
Was it ever? I mean,
I don't know.
It's right up there with technocraty. I don't think it really ever existed.
All right, so the technocraty echoed across the blogosphere with comments about Andrew Sullivan. And Paul Krugman from the New York Times jumped in. Krugman, of course, still blogging and very popular in his own right. And Krugman had the following to say. He wrote, quote, "I think we're missing a crucial part of the history of political blogging if we fail to acknowledge the importance back in the early 2000s of right-wing war bloggers, which is where Andrew Sullivan started. You hardly hear about most of these people now, but for a while, cheering on the Rumsfeld Doctrine and giving it to lily-livered liberals was a big part of the blogosphere, certainly the part given any attention by mainstream news media, and that was Andrew Sullivan." Now, Andrew Sullivan curated a digital book called I Was Wrong, and linked to many of his supportive comments cheering on the Iraq invasion. And Leonard, at least again, he's saying, I have the self-awareness to say, look how wrong I was.
Well, the point I made in the break, Evan, was that it's one thing to admit your mistakes, which is a good thing.
Which is rare enough.
Rare enough, true that. But the difference between Paul Krugman and Andrew Sullivan is that Paul Krugman was right at the right time. If we assume that going to war in Iraq was a mistake, which I think a large majority of Americans believe, then, well, good for Andrew Sullivan for saying he was wrong in the end, but there were a lot of bloggers who were at the time pretty much, derided for their views opposing the war. who had the courage to state them and were right at the right time and are still right today.
But Paul writes, he used that phrase, right-wing war bloggers. Is that a thing? I mean, is that a connotation that still has a function? I mean, in 2015? Doug, you're saying no?
I don't think as much. I think that was kind of a unique time. And when it comes to describing war bloggers, I'd also like to say that I think there's maybe plenty of people swallowing the Rumsfeld Doctrine and writing about it who I don't think they were right in retrospect, but I don't necessarily have a problem with them saying that and believing that. My problem with Sullivan as a war blogger was that a huge amount of it was about caricaturing and attacking the people who are anti-war. And that's always been my big problem with Andrew Sullivan. I agree with the caller, Joe, who said he appreciated Sullivan's honesty. I do, too. But there's too much calling people out for extreme statements. His Moore Award, which I'm a proud recipient of several nominations for left-wing stuff that's over the top. And what does he call his other one? The Malkin Award for right-wing stuff.
Michelle Malkin, yeah.
I don't like that kind of policing and censorship. And that, to me, was the part of war blogging that bothered me, is that it was a policing, it was a censorship of people who were anti-war. It was censorship is maybe too strong of a word, but it was trying to police the bounds of what was acceptable to say in a way that I think is just completely antithetical to what the quote-unquote blogosphere should be about.
I guess I'm kind of mystified by the whole idea in the first place, because I was there blogging that whole time, and for the most part, it was mostly liberals that I was reading. And it wasn't just because that's what I was reading. I'm linking to all kinds of stuff. The voices of, Talking Points Memo and of Daily Kos. I had to hold my nose, but I would occasionally read it. Those were the voices that I was hearing. And most of everything conservative was happening on talk radio. It was kind of the dichotomy at the time was that here you have blogs that are predominantly liberal in origin. And then you have the right-wing talkers that are right-wing. Right. I always thought of that as a very specific dichotomy. In fact, amongst the reasons that I don't eulogize Andrew Sullivan leaving blogging is because, honestly, he wasn't around when I was doing it. He might have been around, but he wasn't around me. You know what I mean? He didn't have any impact on me until he started showing up on Sunday morning Yakker shows, which, by the way, he was on those because he already was a publisher and already was a journalist. It's a little weird to talk about a professional journalist who decides to dip into blogging and then dip back out of blogging and talk about him as though he defined blogging in some way.
But 300 posts a week is a lot. His output was pretty...
He had a large staff.
Right. That's the other. That's another way he's not a traditional blogger.
He did have a staff
from the get-go.
Yeah. And a paid staff.
Correct.
Who was helping him and
probably underpaid, but
aren't we all?
but then let me draw the next question out. Then outside of war blogging, when we look at political blogs, sometimes when we talk about the difference in the parties, if we look from a local level to a state level to a national level, the cliche is that Republicans are very good at being a team, that they are lockstep, that they understand from the top down what the game plan is and they can carry it out very effectively. Democrats are more disorganized. There's more dissent within the ranks, and they get steamrolled a lot for that. And so I don't know if that's fair or not. Is it reflected in blogging? Doug, do you see a difference?
I don't think there is now. I think that's traditionally very true. I mean, I think the old saying, I'm not a member of any organized party, I'm a Democrat, was a very true thing. But I think maybe it's equally true of Republicans now. I mean, when I read Red State a little bit, and it's mostly devoted to attacking more moderate Republicans. I mean, right. And there's plenty of, I also read the American Conservative a fair amount, many of whom are a little more moderate. And a lot of what they do is spend their time attacking Tea Partiers. So I feel like the conservative movement has become more like what the liberal movement has always been like. And frankly, I think it's quite healthy.
In other words, if Daniel Larson and Eric Erickson can both exist within that sphere, there's plenty of disorganization.
Yeah. I think the disorganization is good. I think that maybe was, part of the lesson of Iraq. So many people, especially on the right, but not just the right even, were so happy to line up in lockstep support behind George W. Bush. And these were not necessarily all people who had neoconservative beliefs to begin with. A lot of them might have even been isolationist by nature, but you had to get behind your guy. I think it was unhealthy, and I'm glad to see that that's, I think, less and less true of the conservative
movement. Sure. It was the great journalist, what was it, Brian Williams, who said that I think it was in 2003 or 2004, he indicated that there is a chance that the world would come to realize that George W. Bush's view would be revolutionary and essentially celebrated for generations for spreading. And I don't know Brian Williams personally, but in journalism, that viewpoint was taking hold at the time that, hey, maybe this is a domino and this is what needs to happen and we're all sort of on board with it. I'm not saying we were all on board. I'm saying that Tom's right. It wasn't just right-wingers or neocons. So that's an interesting look at the way blogging has evolved.
That may not necessarily be a question so much of blogging as it is a question of power in general. It's easy. One of the big lessons I learned from being a political blogger back during the Bush administration is that opposition to power is not the same thing as unity. It's easy to feel like you have unity against an opposition when you are all, we all just hate George Bush. That's easy. We got that, right? Okay, cool. But then the minute Barack Obama becomes the president, that old alliance just fractures. And even in Rochester, the blogging community fractured because everybody goes off and is on their own specific issue. And that happens to be a problem with liberals in general. We're all very issue specific political activists. But, and also it's worth saying that success breeds more success and failure breeds a lot of infighting and backbiting. And that, I think, is probably happening amongst Republicans and conservatives right now.
All right, let me get Jake's comment in here. Jake writes to the program, I wonder if the move away from traditional blogging to more microblogging like Twitter, and there's that word, Leah Stacey, microblogging, and other social media platforms might be related somewhat to the conversation about TV anchoring you had yesterday. Perhaps more people are looking for a lot of varied viewpoints and pure information rather than personality and drama in their news. I, for one, hope so. Leah, you think he's on the money with that?
I do, yeah. I think that's part of the beauty of what we have with blogs now, too, is that you can pick and choose. I guess what I've been sitting here wondering is, and maybe this is a question for everyone. Am I allowed to ask a question?
Sure.
Okay.
You can play host.
I mean, RSS feeds, Google Reader, how are you guys organizing now? Because those are things of the past now. So how do you organize? I mean, we only have so many hours in the day. How do you encourage your readers to organize, or how are you organizing and keeping up with all of this stuff? Because I know I only follow very few blogs because I have so many other things to do, full-time job, teaching on the side. And I always wonder, these communities, how do these people find time to really read so much?
RSS forever.
RSS.
Forever. I love RSS. I live and
breathe
RSS.
Leonard is grabbing, yeah? Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So it's not a thing of the past to you?
It's not a thing of the past to me. It irritates me every time somebody gets rid of their newsfeed, actually.
Is happening everywhere.
Which is happening almost everywhere.
Yeah.
But, one thing that has not really been discussed so far, but it really does matter from a technological standpoint, is the fact that everything about what we're talking about boils down to not necessarily whether blogs are dead, but the fact that the thing that made blogs popular, the thing that made blogs possible, the distribution of information, has so subsumed our culture that in a lot of ways we don't even necessarily realize it. Netflix is based on some of the same basic protocols that drove RSS feeds, that drive blogging. What we called Web 2.0 meant that you were able to share your data on your website with anybody else, with an RSS feed or with some form of XML, SOAP, right? Any number of different technologies. That concept has completely diversified in a way that most people don't completely understand. So, Twitter becomes the next thing. And God, I love Twitter. I love Twitter so much, but it still only winds up being a symptom of a larger thing that is long from being over with. Now your refrigerator will send you information on Twitter if you need it to. And so that's just a question of that information becoming more widely a part of your life.
Well, the other 2006, when blogs were, just to pick a year, RSS was kind of the only way to get a feed of anything. But Twitter, since supposedly, you know, 2006, we've had Twitter, Facebook, Tumblr, Pinterest, and, you know, 50 other social media platforms. So it's blogs haven't died. There's just a wider variety of things that you can do to self-publish than you could in 2006 or 2000.
Mm-hmm. And Twitter's not without flaws. Oh, I mean, yeah. For one, there's a lot of cruft. Even, and I'll say that for my own feed. You know, I write a lot of stuff that doesn't have anything to do with what I'm doing for my website or my focus at all. And I'm just sharing stuff just because I'm being social with people.
Which I think you need to do.
Which is fun. Yeah. But the thing of it is, as information sources go, that makes it that much worse as an aggregator. Mm-hmm. You can't aggregate my content and expect to get anything out of that. You know, you can only just sort of enjoy it at the moment, and then it goes away.
Of course, because you're a person, not an RSS feed.
But if the question is, how do you aggregate, how do you organize your life, Twitter does not help that. As much as I've tried, and I have my lists and stuff that I use to try to organize things, it does not organize information. It actually makes it a lot worse, which is why I still use RSS, because I can still get a news feed of a specific topic.
A comment from Richard, and I'm trying to condense a bit. Richard writes, "The mistake of the Iraq War years was the echo chamber. Blogs became a place to join a team, not learn something new. That has changed." Yes or no?
I think blogs are a place to learn something new. Yeah, I think that he's saying it was an echo chamber.
Yeah,
and
it was an echo chamber. Essentially, you wanted to go somewhere where it was sort of a rally around a cause or listen to someone who always agreed with you.
I don't know exactly what blogs were like then, because in 2003, 4, I guess it would be, because I wasn't reading a lot besides Talking Points Memo. But I think it's definitely true now. I do think that I don't think that blogs serve that much as an echo chamber. Even when I read blogs that are highly partisan, I do feel like there's a I can't predict perfectly what they're going to say. I don't feel like they're that much of an echo chamber, no.
Leonard?
Yeah, I agree. And part of it is, where's the agency of the reader in all this echo chamber talk? Doesn't somebody have to pick what they want to read? If somebody wants to go and just find things that reinforce their own opinion, that's the choice of the reader, not the publisher. Right?
Yeah, and I don't think that's healthy at all. Chris Eliza for The Washington Post. Is it still the fix? It's still a fix, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's been a fix since 2008 for The Washington Post. He writes, "It's important to realize a blog isn't any one thing. For me, the idea of a blog or blogging that works is reported analysis told through a variety of textual and visual mediums. You could call them, as newspapers tend to do, analysis pieces and run them as articles. You could call them, as the graphics world does, data visualizations and run them as infographics. The bigger point is, it's journalism on the web. It doesn't matter what word you ascribe to it. And as long as people want to read smart and shareable analysis on issues in the news, I think blogging, at least as I conceptualize it, will be just fine."
Isn't I Has Cheeseburger a blog?
I can Has Cheeseburger.
Yeah, I'm not sure if that's really the journalistic
Probably not journalism.
Yeah. I mean, that's the problem, is any discussion of blogging gets a little weird because it's not a software. There's plenty of different types of software. It's not journalism. It could be in some cases, but it isn't always. It isn't any one thing, like he says, and even when he defines it, it's over narrow. It could be anything. You could be blogging about your cat, or a lot of people put up their poems or they put their writing up. So, it's self-publication is probably the best definition. But even that doesn't work because, of course, Chris Eliza writes, for a company. So it doesn't really fall into that definition either.
Doug, you were going to jump in. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I don't think it's right to call it all journalism. I mean, I believe that journalism is a profession. I realize it's not a licensed profession, but it is one where I like to think that, people have certain ethics, certain standards, don't make up stories about getting shot at when they're in helicopter or stuff like that. And I think that bloggers, part of the point of blogging is not to be held to that standard. It's supposed to be a little bit more freewheeling, I think. But some of that freewheelingness does make it, to me, not really rising to the standards of journalism.
The very first time I met Miss Stacy, the first thing I told her was, "I am not a journalist. I am a blogger," and I stand by it.
But some bloggers can practice or can conduct and can engage in journalism, even if not every blog post is journalism, right, Lynn?
Yeah. We have some freelance writers who have pretty heavy lifestyle or personal blogs on the side. One of my photographers has a lifestyle blog that is read pretty widely across the nation and followed, and they do contests, and they, you know, openly endorse things from Target and things from Kohl's and do giveaways. But her work with me is separate. Her work with me follows our guidelines. She has a contract with me. She has training that has prepared her to come in and work with the magazine. What she does on the side with her blog is, you know, they make the call. They are the publisher. And I agree that journalism and professional bloggers, I even hesitate to use that term. I think if you're a professional, maybe it's something that you do every day and you're skilled at, yes. But I think the line is too gray sometimes. And I think that I always appreciated that Tom said that, because I appreciate when people know the difference. You know, you can't get a degree in blogging yet. We'll see if that ever happens.
Yeah, maybe. Well, I like to read Press Think by Jay Rosen, and I don't know what our panel thinks. What's that?
Excellent. Terrific.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Jay Rosen. It's pressthink.org, and Jay Rosen is a New York University journalism professor. And he recently noted that the ideal standard in news is the newsroom gathers and reports the news, and the sales department sells that product. They say that's the ideal standard. The sales department is not involved in what the journalism is. The sales department does not send ideas down. The sales department does not say, hey, can you do this? The sales department, if you have to sell ad space or time, the only thing you are selling is the quality of that journalism. That's the gold standard. And the farther away you are from that, the more you have to ask yourself if you can tolerate it. That's Jay Rosen's construction. I think it's a good one. And, you know, but blogs are the same way. The issue I have is with transparency. And that's actually something that Andrew Sullivan really covered a lot of. When you see Slate putting stories on, the headline looks the same as the Slate headline, et cetera, and then, you know, featured content or advertised content is a small line. I've got a problem with that. And that's what we're seeing a whole lot more of, whether it's on a blog and you don't know it. I want to know as a reader, whether I'm reading a blog or whether I'm watching a newscast or whatever, that certain I want to know that there's a separation with the sales department, and I feel that that's dissolved to some degree.
I feel that with blogs, one of the nice things with most blogs is that we're too unimportant to be bribed. And so I think
I don't know. 50,000 readers a day is not unimportant anymore, unfortunately. Can't you be bribed? Isn't there a price for everybody?
I think that I'd be willing to be bribed under the right circumstances, but I haven't, you know, nothing attractive has come my way yet.
John Cole, the creator, do you know? I mean, are there essentially offers or approaches of others who would like to?
Not that I'm. I don't think
no?
so.
You'd have to get much bigger, Leonard.
Somebody wants to buy balloon shoes. Maybe in the go-go days, somebody would think that it was something worth something. But I don't know. It's interesting to look at the balloon juice and Wonkette. Wonkette is another sort of liberal blog with a lot of jokes. It's interesting to look at those two because I think there's a divergence there that sort of shows the difference between the two. Balloon Juice is still run by this one guy. Wonkette was bought by Gawker Media, I think, and then spun off because it wasn't making enough money for Nick Denton. However much money that is, it's got to be a lot. But anyway, if you look at Wonkette, you'll see that it is just the ads in there are the most intrusive ads on almost any site that I ever visit. But I think it's kind of it shows you exactly how obnoxious a website has to be in order to make money. Because I think that site is barely making money. And so your Slate example is a good one. So, and I think the reason is because it's a really not a very good revenue model. I think the right revenue model is the one that the Vox media empire is going after. Vox, which is their political arm. Then they have The Verge, which is their technology arm. And they started with Sports Nation. Those aren't cluttered with ads. They look for sponsorship, and I think they're making a lot of money on that.
I know. Maybe that is the future. Real briefly, I don't even know if we consider Mike Allen's Playbook a blog, but that's for sale. I mean, we know that's for sale. That's been well documented, hasn't it?
Yeah, that's about as bad as things get.
I mean, really awful. Right. But that's what I'm talking about. I mean, he had to be basically shamed for his readers to know what was even sort of paid content and what was his own. So,
but if I can take the counter argument here, there's a great book, if you can ever find it, called The Main Street Beat, written by a Mr. Clune, who was a reporter here in Rochester through the 20s through about the 60s. And every single editor that he worked for was a cigar-chomping, milk-of-magnesia-drinking editor that was always on the line between being completely broke and writing good stories, or having money and maybe not being able to write the story that they wanted to write about Rochester. I think that the idea, which I think sort of extends from television news, this sort of ivory tower idea that journalists should be completely separate from the business of making money. Well, wouldn't that be nice if we could all do that? But we all need our job. Everybody needs to make money, and your company needs to make money. So I don't necessarily I think that that is a little irresponsible to say that, well, the sales department can't have anything to do with the editorial, and the editorial can't have anything to do with sales. I think that is a demon in and of itself, where you have a sales department that is just making whatever they can do to make money, and editorials that don't follow
what
people
want.
We're
almost out of time, and now we have the seed for another hour of discussion, Tom Belknap. Last quick question, 20 seconds. I'll give it to Leonard. One of our readers wants to know, I would kill to get a must-check RSS feed from one of your guests today.
Must-check RSS feed. Balloon-juice.com.
Anybody else?
Space.com, always good for me.
Space.com.
I actually had to quit RSS because I was too addicted to it.
And Leah, you see RSS
dying. I would say download Flipboard, the app. Flipboard.
Okay.
Curate.
Thanks, everybody. Leah Stacey, I'll see you at Nazareth. We teach pretty close to each other.
We do.
So we do have some
we
of
may
the same
pass
students.
In the tunnel.
We may. Thanks for taking the time, Leah. Tom Belknap, DragonflyEye.net. Thank you very much, sir.
Thanks so much.
From Balloon Juice, balloon-juice.com. Doug J. and Leonard is Mr. Mix. Thanks, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, short break and another hour straight ahead right here on Connection.